If you'll grab a Bible and turn it to the book of Esther. Book of Esther. Hope that you are able to get outside for at least a few minutes to enjoy the beautiful sunshine. I don't know about you, but I am very thankful it is spring. Even though we had a mild winter, this Georgia boy is just thankful whenever the sun comes out and warms things up. If you have a calendar that shows those obscure holidays that are relevant to cultures other than our American culture, then you may have noticed that on Tuesday of this week, there's something, a holiday called Purim that's going to be celebrated. And this is a holiday that's a Jewish holiday. It memorializes how God saved his people through the hand of Esther from complete annihilation. And it was read for us tonight from Esther chapter 9, how Mordecai set a decree that people should celebrate, that God's people, the Jews, should celebrate this feast with joy and feasting and by sharing gifts to one another and donating to the poor. Those are all things that Jews practice even today because of this feast. And it explains how this feast came to be known as Purim. So what I want to do tonight is I want to tell you the story of Esther. It really is an amazing story, a beautiful story of God's redemption, God's deliverance on behalf of his people. And so I want to think about the story tonight, not just from a perspective of if we were Israelites, then it will be significant, but what about us Christians? You know, what's the significance of this story to our lives and our faith in Christ as Christians? I want to begin just tonight by telling you the story. If you've read this story before, then you're probably familiar with it. But we're just going to go through the story. I'm just going to read sections of it that are the more important sections that I want to highlight certain themes and certain things. But then after I tell the story, we're going to talk about some things we learn and, of course, how it's relevant to us as Christians. So the story of Esther takes place about 100 years after the Jews are taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon. And at this point, Babylon has fallen. The Medo-Persian Empire has taken over. And the story begins in Esther chapter 1 with King Ahasuerus, or he's also known in history as King Xerxes. And he is instituting a feast, or hosting a feast, that's displaying his power and his glory and his might and his riches to all the people. And the story takes place in the capital of Persia named Susa. And this feast lasts for 6 months plus 1 week. And in verse 8, it says that the drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion. The Christian Standard Bible in verse 8 says there was no restriction on drinking. So as the Persians often did, they just drank themselves silly. This is quite a party here. The king is lavishing his guests and all the people with his gifts, and they're just living it up. Now, on the final day of this feast, King Ahasuerus summons his wife, Queen Vashti, to show off her beauty. And what he's doing here is basically treating her as one of his physical treasures. He's treating her as an object. Remember, this feast is about showing off his wealth. And so he's using her as an object to display not her beauty, but his own glory. Her beauty reflects on his greatness. And so she flatly refuses. She does not come. So as a consequence, he deposes her. He gets rid of her. Now, in order to replace the queen, his advisor suggests that he hold a beauty pageant, basically, to replace her, to gather all of the beautiful young virgins in the kingdom to find out who the next queen should be. And it just so happens that there's a young Jewish girl named Esther who is taken into the palace. She is very, very beautiful, so stunning that the queen falls in love with her immediately. Now, we learn about Esther some important facts. She is an orphan. She is raised by her cousin Mordecai. And as we said, she is very beautiful. And she is Jewish. But as she's taken into the harem along with hundreds of other young women, she goes through 12 months of beauty treatments, basically, and kind of an overkill, don't you think? 12 months. But basically what they're doing is preparing these young virgins for the one opportunity that they'll have, one evening, that they'll have to impress the king and become the next queen. Esther is immediately chosen as soon as Ahasuerus leaves, or his eyes fall on her. Now, as she's taken into the harem as the queen, or taken into, married to him, she does not reveal her Jewish identity. Now, that's going to be very important to the story, so hold on to that thought. She does not reveal that she is a Jew according to Mordecai's instruction. At the end of chapter 2, we read this kind of a side story. It says in verse 21, "In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now, when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence." So again, keep that story in the back of your mind, because that is going to be important. I want you to notice a couple things here right off the bat. What are the odds that Esther, a Jewish girl, would be chosen as the next queen? And even more so, what are the odds that it would be Mordecai, of all people, who would happen to overhear this plot to assassinate the king, so that Mordecai could inform Esther, and Esther could inform the king and save the king's life? In chapter 3, we read the first part of chapter 3, we're introduced to this man named Haman. Now, verse 1, it says, "After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him." Now, there's some very fundamental things we need to understand about Haman. He's introduced to us as an Agagite. He is a descendant of the king of the Amalekites back in 1 Kings chapter 15, named Agag. The Amalekites, if you remember, were the ancient enemies of God. We read from Exodus chapter 17 in our lesson this morning about how Joshua was sent to fight against the Amalekites. That's what God did not like. They had set their mind against God, and so God had ordered that as soon as they enter into the promised land, they were to wipe out completely the Amalekites because of what they did to Israel whenever they came out of Egypt. And you remember the story of how Saul was told in 1 Samuel chapter 15 to go and wipe them out, but he kept Agag alive, and he kept the best of the flock so the people could sacrifice. And it took Samuel killing Agag, but apparently Agag's son survived because of that. So interestingly, we see here that Agag's descendants are still living, and they're still, as we're going to see, setting their minds against God and against God's people through this descendant named Haman. Now, what's interesting is that Mordecai is also a descendant of an important figure. If you look at chapter 2, in verse 5, when we're introduced to Mordecai, it says that he is a son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now, you compare that to 1 Samuel chapter 9, when we're introduced to King Saul. King Saul was a Benjamite, a son of Kish. And so we have these two descendants of important figures, and here in the story, they're going to come together again. It's like the ancient conflict between Amalek and God and his people, because Saul did not do his job at the beginning. It's going to come together again. Keep that in mind. Now, as Haman is exalted by the king, everyone in the court is commanded to bow down to him, but Mordecai does not. It says in verse 2 of chapter 3, "All the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage." So the conflict begins here. Mordecai refuses to bow down. Whether he knows about Haman's lineage, I don't know. Or whether this man is just not a respectable man, I do not know. But he refuses to bow. Even when his companions say to him, "Look, we need to bow. You're going to get yourself in trouble," he still refuses to bow. That makes Haman very furious. So in the second part of chapter 3, we read that when he goes out and Mordecai does not bow, he is enraged. And it says in verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. For they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. He is not happy to destroy Haman, to destroy Mordecai alone. He wants to destroy all the Jews. So what he does is he plots to kill the Jews, and he rolls what's known as the pure, or casts the lot, something of a Persian form of the dice, in order to decide when his plot should take place. Keep that word pure, or P-U-R, in mind. That's going to come up in the story. Now, the Persians believed in something known as predetermined fate, and so that's why he's casting the lot here to determine when he should make this go into effect. But we're going to see in the story that it's really not the dice that's in control. There's something or someone who is really in control. So Haman goes to the king and he convinces the king to destroy, to annihilate all the Jewish people. He does not reveal why he's doing this, at least not yet. In chapter 4, Mordecai and Esther hear of this. And when they do, they tear their clothes. Mordecai tears his clothes. He puts on sackcloth and ashes. And he urges Esther to go to the king about this matter. Haman's plot is still unknown. The true reasons for it are unknown. But Esther responds, I can't approach the king right now. I haven't seen him for 30 days. He has not summoned me. Now, to go to the king unsummoned and without an appointment was a crime worthy of death, unless the king would extend his scepter to you. So Esther says, I can't approach the king. He hasn't summoned me for 30 days. Imagine not seeing your husband for 30 days, but that's the way they operated them. And then Mordecai says in verse 13 of chapter 4, these famous words, do not imagine that you and the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? So Mordecai and Esther and all the Jews are in a really tough spot right here. The decree has gone out through all of the city, through all of the provinces of Persia, that the Jews are to be destroyed on the 14th day of Adar, and there's nothing they can do about it, except possibly Esther. What Mordecai says here, and we'll come back to this later on in the lesson, is Esther, it could be that you have become queen for this exact moment. So, Esther decides to go in, and she says in verse 16 to Mordecai, go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way. And thus I will go into the king, which is not according to law. And if I perish, I perish. Consider the courage that she has in those words. If I die trying to save my people, then let it be so. The story continues in chapter 5 when Esther goes through with the plan and she enters the king's presence, and lo and behold, it just so happens the king extends his scepter to her, and so he invites her into his presence, and she invites Haman and the king to a feast. During that feast, the king asks her, what is it that you wish? And she says, I want you to come to my feast tomorrow. Now, because Haman was invited to this feast, he leaves the feast feeling really, really good about himself. Look at chapter 5 in verse 9. Then Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he did not stand up or tremble before him, he was filled with anger against Mordecai. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife, Zeresh. And so what he does here is he throws a pity/boasting party. In verse 11, he recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and the servants of the king. Look at how good I am, he's saying. Haman also said, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet. which she had prepared. And tomorrow I also am invited by her with the king. I wonder how his family and his friends put up with that kind of boasting. Just look at how good I am. Look at all the good things the king has done for me. I am so much better than everybody else. But here's his pity party in verse 13. All of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. All of these good things have been put on me. I'm such a good person. Why doesn't Mordecai recognize how good I am? Then in verse 14, Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends said to him, "Have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet." And the advice pleased Haman, and so he had the gallows made. Things don't look great for Esther, for Mordecai, or for the Jews. Mordecai is pretty much on death row at this point. The Jews are fixing to be annihilated in just a few months, and Esther herself with them. Until we reach chapter 6. Chapter 6 is the pivotal moment in this story. It's where the story turns around, and it's probably the funniest chapter in the entire Bible. It says in verse 1, "During that night the king could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king." So it just so happens that the king can't sleep that night, and so he asks his servants to read him a bedtime story. In verse 2, it was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king remembers that. "Well, I forgot to thank Mordecai. What has been done for him to show my gratitude for him?" And the servants say, "Nothing has been done." It just so happens that the servants read about what Mordecai had done to save his life. And so in verse 4, the king said, "Who is in the court?" And it just so happens that Haman is the one entering the court, remember, to ask permission to hang his enemy Mordecai on the gallows this very morning. And it says in verse 5, "The king's servant said to him, 'Behold, Haman is standing in the court.' And the king said, 'Let him come in.' So Haman came in, and the king said to him, 'What is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor?' And Haman said to himself, 'Who would the king desire to honor more than me?'" That's the way a person so full of himself thinks. You know, if something good is going to happen, it always has to happen to me because I'm better than everyone else. Who else would the king want to honor more than me? Then Haman said to the king, thinking of himself, "For the man whom the king desires to honor, let them bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, on whose head a royal crown has been placed. And let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor and lead him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, 'Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor.'" You hear the irony in this. In verse 10, the king said to Haman, "Take quickly the robes and the horse as you have said, and do so for Mordecai." Not for you, Haman. You weren't saying all of this stuff for you, despite your prideful thinking, but rather for your enemy. And so Mordecai is taken through the streets by Haman himself, led through the streets and paraded around, and Haman himself has to say, "This is the one the king wants to honor." And after that parade is done, Haman goes home with his tail tucked between his legs, feeling absolutely mortified. In verse 12, "Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home, mourning with his head covered. Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him, 'If Mordecai, before whom you have become to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him.'" Haman is in a collision course with his own pride, and there's no way to stop it or turn around. And so you see from this point forward, Haman begins to fall. In chapter 7, Esther gives her second banquet. And while Haman is sulking, the servants arrive and whisk him away to Esther's second banquet. And during that banquet, it is there that Esther reveals her Jewish origin. I am a Jew, she says. And not only that, but she exposes Haman for who he is. For the villain in the story, it is because of him and his pride, his wounded pride, that he has come up with this plan to completely destroy the Jews. This is a very dramatic moment. And at the end of chapter 7, in a very grim twist of events, in such irony, the king, when he hears this, he commands that Haman be hanged on the gallows that he had built for Mordecai. Can anyone say poetic justice there? You read this story and you have to consider that God has something of a sense of humor when you read this. I mean, God is looking down from heaven and saying, you know, look at this proud man who is plotting to destroy and get rid of my people, but I'm going to bring him down in a twist of irony. In chapter 8, the first part of chapter 8, Haman is dead, but that doesn't take care of the plot against the Jews. And so Esther goes to the king again and pleads with the king to change this decree. But it can't be revoked, okay? Persian law cannot be revoked once it comes into effect. And so Mordecai appeals to the king and says, well, let's write out a second decree. Let's counteract this decree with another decree authorizing the Jews on the 14th day of Adar to fight back against anyone who plotted to destroy them. So the Jews are now authorized to hold their ground and defend themselves against anyone who would do Haman's will. And after this, Mordecai is elevated. He is given Haman's ring, and his possessions are given to Esther, and Mordecai is given charge of those things. And as Mordecai is the one who writes the decree in the same way that Haman wrote the decree to destroy the Jews. And when his decree is sent out, it's received with great rejoicing and celebration in the city. And the book ends with talking about Mordecai's greatness, how he is elevated and exalted to the second position of the kingdom under the king himself. And so we read in chapter 9 how Esther and Mordecai institute the feast of Purim, which means lots, as a reminder of how the Jews were saved from Haman's evil plot. So a couple of interesting things about this story. You'll notice that it kind of goes in reverse order. It begins with Haman exalting himself and the king exalting himself. But here in chapter 6, the story pivots. Haman is brought down and God's people are elevated. This is such an incredibly beautiful story. I like to think of this story as a series of fortunate events. So much happens in this story that seems so coincidental, but has to be much more than just coincidence. Look at a few of these so-called coincidences. First of all, what are the odds that Esther would be chosen as the queen? And what are the odds that Mordecai would overhear the plot to kill the king, and so he would tell Esther, who would tell the king? And what are the chances that Esther would go into the king's presence against law, but the king would receive her into his presence and extend his scepter? And what are the odds that the king that night, when Haman planned to go to the king the very next morning, that he can't sleep? And what are the odds that he calls upon his servants to read him the annals, the accounts of the history, and it just so happens that they read about Mordecai. It just so happens that he realizes, I need to thank Mordecai. And what are the odds that it just so happens that Haman would enter the room at the exact moment when the king is thinking about glorifying and thanking Mordecai? And what are the odds that Haman, of all people, must exalt Mordecai, and that Haman would be hanged on his own gallows, and ultimately that the Jews will be delivered from what certainly seemed like certain destruction? Now, the question we have to ask ourselves as we read and look at this story is, what's going on here? What is really moving this plot along? Do we attribute these coincidences to random chance? Remember, Haman threw the dice, basically, to determine when the Jews would die. He chalked it up to fate. When should the Jews die? He trusted in fate. Is that what's going on here? This is just random chance? Or is it God unseen? The interesting thing about the book of Esther is that God is never mentioned by name, not even once in this whole book. There's only one other book in the Bible that's like that, the book of Song of Solomon. And there's one place where the Lord's personal name, Yahweh, could possibly be mentioned. But nowhere in Esther is God's name mentioned at all. But I think this is a deliberate attempt on the book of Esther's author's part. This is an invitation for us to see God working not outright in front of the stage, but behind the scenes. God is working unseen in the entire story. Let's go to Esther chapter 4 to Mordecai's words. I said we'll come back to this because this is key. This is one of the places where we see God implicitly mentioned in the book. Mordecai, remember, is saying to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews for another place, and you and your father's house will perish." First of all, why would Mordecai say that? Why would he say that if you don't do anything about this, relief and deliverance is going to come from somewhere else? What gives Mordecai the confidence to say that? Because he trusted in God's faithful promises. These were God's people. The descendants of Abraham, the descendants of the patriarchs whom God had proven himself to be faithful and loyal to time and time again. It was to them that God promised that the seed of Christ would come. It is because he believes in God that God would do something, if not through Esther, through someone else to save his people. But then he says something else. This question in verse 14, "And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" Now, Mordecai doesn't know for sure what God is doing in this story, but he has a clue. Mordecai here, I keep getting them mixed up, and they're probably rolling over in their graves when I'm doing that. But Mordecai, I think, is trusting God's sovereign control here. Who knows that you have not attained royalty for such a... Why Esther of all people? Why would God choose Esther of all people to become the next queen? Because he is doing something behind the scenes here. One of the things that the Bible teaches about God is that he is in control of all things. Yes, he lets us have free will. He lets us make our own choices. But even then, God can use our choices, turn them to do his good will. The book of Proverbs, chapter 16, verse 33, is interesting on this point. It says, "The lot is cast into the lap." Remember Haman's dice. "But its every decision is from the Lord." Who's really in control here? Is it Haman and fate and random choice and the dice? Or is it God who is in control? The book of Esther invites us to see God's working behind the scenes in everyday life and everyday things. And I think this is an invitation for us to reflect on how God uses his providence today. Let's just think for a couple of minutes on what God's providence means. The word providence just comes from the idea of God providing for his people. What we need to understand is that God is active today. We're living in a day when we don't see miracles happen like they did in Bible times. We don't see prophecy taking place, but God is still active today, and we need to understand that, we need to trust that, and we need to appreciate that. I think a lot of times when people look at God, they want God to do something big, something extraordinary. They're expecting something miraculous, something out of the ordinary to happen in their lives for them to trust in God. And what they fail to realize is that God is working every single day in our lives. He doesn't have to work something miraculous or extraordinary in our lives for us to see how he is working. God is active even today. What's interesting about the book of Esther is it proves that. God is never mentioned. In fact, no one receives a revelation from God in Esther. There's no prophet in the book of Esther that reveals God's mind. There are no miracles that take place. But behind the scene, you see God's hand every step of the way. So God's work is not limited to the miraculous or the prophetic or the extraordinary. He does work in ordinary circumstances to fulfill his purposes. How does that happen today? A few examples that I thought of. Go to the book of Philemon for just a minute. Book of Philemon, Paul references what I think is God's providence. Remember, Philemon is this letter to Philemon. Paul is sending Philemon's slave Onesimus back. Apparently, Onesimus had run away from Philemon and run into Paul, and so now he's sending him back. But notice verse 15 and 16. Paul says, "For perhaps he, Onesimus, was for this reason separated from you for a while, that you would have him back forever, no longer as a slave, but more than a slave, a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the Lord." Notice what he's saying here. It could be that perhaps he ran away from you for a time so that he would run into me and learn the gospel of Christ. And so I could return him to you, not as a slave, but more than that, as a brother. I think he's saying something about the providence of God, that God can place people in our lives to bring about his will, whether to hear the gospel or to hear some good advice for our lives. God can do that in our lives. Think also about how God provides for us daily, just the physical provisions we have. I mean, Jesus promises us in Matthew 6 that God will, as a faithful, loving Father, give us the food and the clothing and the shelter we need. So don't worry about it. Don't be anxious about your life. How does God do that? You know, if you lose your job and you pray for a job opening to open up, how does God answer that prayer? Does he do that through providence? How does God provide for you if and the stock market goes down, and as we were talking about this morning, and maybe we lose life savings? How does God provide for us in those circumstances? He does that through answered prayers. He does that through his providence. James chapter 5 talks about healing, praying for those that are sick. James chapter 5 and verse 14, it says, if anyone is sick, then he must call for the elders of the church, and they are to pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. I think here the oil is probably for medicinal purposes. It was often used. Remember the story of the Good Samaritan, when the Samaritan man comes, he puts the man on his donkey and he puts oil on his wounds, he dresses his wounds. It was used for medicinal purposes. While we pray for healing, that doesn't mean that we can't seek medical treatments at the same time. God can use those things to bring about his will in healing us. And think also about when we pray about opportunities to teach the gospel. Paul commands us to do just that in Colossians chapter 4 and verse 3, praying at the same time for us as well, that God will open up a door to us for the word, so that we may speak forth the mystery of Christ, for which I have also been imprisoned. The thing we need to realize about God's providence is that it is constantly working for us. And is that a comfort to you? To know that God sees you, that when you pray for blessings, when you pray to him, what's on your mind and what about his will might be, he hears those prayers. God is active. He can work in your life today, and he will work in your life today. But the key to this is trust. Do we trust that God is able to do that even though we may not see? Trust is the key to God's providence. It was trust that led Mordecai to say to Esther, "Who knows whether you have not become royalty for such a time as this?" It was trust that led Esther to go into the king's presence saying, "If I perish, I perish. If I die, then let it be for a good purpose." It's what they operated upon in the most crucial moment in the story. They walked by faith and not by sight. And we need to think of God's providence in the same way. Do we trust in our unseen God? And that's really the beauty of the story of Esther, reminding us that behind the scenes, God is always working his will, which is good for his people. But the story of Esther is not just interesting literature. How does the story of Esther fit into the whole picture of the Bible? There's two things I would point out as we close tonight. First of all, Esther plays a key role in the whole story of the Bible in that it really bridges the gap between the Old Testament and the New Testament. If God's people were completely wiped out in the book of Esther, then there would have been no New Testament at all. There would have been no Jewish nation. There would have been no Christ, because the seed promise would have been destroyed. And so this story shows how God preserves his promise to Abraham hundreds of years earlier, that he was so faithful to carry his promise through, even up unto Christ. Because of the story of Esther, the promise of the coming Christ endured and was fulfilled. But speaking of Christ, this story doesn't just bridge us between the Old Testament and the New Testament. I think the story of Esther is a shadow of the very gospel itself. The story of Esther foreshadows what God does on the cross. If you think about the basic story of Esther, it is that God works providentially to save his people when they are on the brink of disaster and death. When their enemies are about to overwhelm and completely destroy them, God intervenes behind the scenes to do his will and to save them. And that's a theme that we've seen throughout the Bible. When you read the story of Esther, it reminds us of the story of Joseph. Don't we see the same thing in Joseph's life? How God uses evil choices against Joseph, who his brothers sold him into slavery, and through that story, he rises to power in Egypt and ends up delivering the people of God. The same thing happens in the story of Esther. And that's the same story of the gospel. That God delivers his people in an amazing way when it seems like all hope is lost. The story of Esther, it appears at first to be a story of great loss and tragedy, but it turns out to be one of great gain and triumph. God is the deliverer of his people. And there's no greater deliverance that we see God doing for his people than what he does on the cross and the resurrection of Christ. This is most clearly seen in what God has done for us through Jesus. So the book of Esther is really an amazing story about God's providence and how he works behind the scenes to bring about his will, but ultimately about how his providence leads us to Jesus, leads us to eternal salvation. And it's an invitation for us to trust in that, to understand that God is working through our lives to bring our hearts to see the love of his Son on the cross through the gospel. And would you trust that tonight? Would you believe in Christ as the Savior? Believe in God as the one who delivers you if you will come to him and believe? Will you act on that faith tonight by confessing that belief, by being baptized and immersed in him? And will you just, after becoming a Christian, will you trust in the Lord, rely on him daily through his providence that cares for you? Think about that as we together stand for your encouragement. Stand and sing.